Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that introduces to WFIU listeners interesting people from Indiana, the United States, and the world. I'm Owen Johnson. Our guest today is David Rocks, who is the Senior Editor for International News for Businessweek magazine. David, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you for having me.
Your major at Colby College was philosophy. That's kind of an unusual major for someone who's now a journalist, especially for someone who has focused a lot on technology. Why philosophy?
I don't think it's unusual at all, frankly, because I was interested in, you know, the love of knowledge, the, you know, why we are what we are, all of the questions that philosophy asks. And then also, perhaps just as important, at Colby, philosophy was the major that had the fewest number of required classes. So I could get a much more broad liberal arts education by doing that. I spent my junior year in France, which kept me from – the fewer requirements that I had to do, the better as far as I was concerned, because I wanted to study as broadly as possible.
My next question was going to be, did you have any involvement with international type things? What did you do in France? Was it just a normal study abroad?
It was a normal study abroad. I went to Paris. I didn't study very hard, as I think most of your listeners who spent a year abroad might relate to. But I played guitar in the metro and learned to speak French, which was the main reason that I went there. I was kind of a C student when I left, and by the time I came back, a couple of years later, I ended up getting a job as a French teacher in a high school. So I obviously learned something, even if I didn't study very hard in order to do it.
Eh bien, nous pouvons parler en français maintenant.
Si vous voulez.
Were you involved in journalism at all as a student?
Not really. I was at my high school in Colorado Springs, Colorado. I was a founding editor of the reconstituted student newspaper, which we called The Bezel, which those in the know would know is a sort of a sharp leading edge on something. But of course, the students of Wasson High School in Colorado Springs didn't understand that. They called it The Bezel, and they thought it was just the lamest thing they'd ever seen. I wouldn't exactly call it journalism, but I think it's somewhere in the back of my head I had the idea that perhaps journalism would be an interesting thing to do. But I was not aimed at being a journalist at all.
What did you do after graduation?
I did after graduation. I went to Italy and worked in a vegetarian restaurant and worked in an olive orchard. And I, again, played guitar on the streets to make a little bit of spare change and just learned Italian. And it was fantastic. Ate a lot, drank a lot, cruised around Florence and Italy and just had a wonderful time.
Did you start your journalism master's degree before you went into journalism, or did you do some journalism before that?
I don't actually have a master's degree in journalism. My master's degree is in something called international communications, which is – I got it from American University in Washington, which is – I kind of thought it might be journalism. I applied for graduate school from Poland. I was living in Poland in 1986 and was studying Polish, living there, just again playing in a band. And I knew that I needed to go home and I thought I wanted to go to graduate school. So I went to the library of the U.S. consulate in Krakow and checked out what I thought were journalism programs, saw this international communication thing that they had at AU, and I applied and I got in and I went and got there and it wasn't journalism and that was fine, but it was a little bit of a haphazard approach to education, I guess you could say.
What was it if it wasn't journalism?
It was everything having to do with communication in international communication in many respects. So we studied telecommunication policy. We studied cross-cultural communications, why Japanese people, you know, suck air through their teeth and say yes when they mean no and things like that. We studied diplomatic communications, how governments communicate with each other, how they get what they want. A little bit of telecommunications technology. This was right at the beginning of the deregulation of telecommunications. And so that ultimately was probably the most important thing that I learned there because there's a very direct line between that field of study and my current job. It's direct if somewhat circuitous, let's say.
You in – I think it was 1991 you wound up in Prague or at least started writing regularly from Prague.
Yeah, I moved to Prague.
What drew you there? I mean I know it was the Paris of the East at the time, the place to be, but was there something else?
Well, as I said, I had lived in Poland and I spoke Polish, and I knew that I wanted to get back to Eastern Europe. I was working for the Associated Press in Chicago at the time, and the AP at the time had I think two or three people in the Chicago bureau who spoke Polish and zero in the Warsaw bureau, and I wanted to be one of the people in the Warsaw bureau, and they didn't move me, and so I decided that I would just go. And so I worked every holiday throughout 1989, and as you know, the fall of 1989 happened, and Prague fell, and you know, the Berlin Wall fell, and Ceausescu was murdered in Romania, and things like that. I was filing high school football scores in the 3 o'clock a.m. weather to Rantoul and Peoria and Springfield and downstate Illinois cities, and I just knew that I needed to get back to Eastern Europe. I also knew that Warsaw is not a particularly lovely place, if anybody's ever been there. I mean, it's got its good points, and I love Poland and I love Poles, so I don't mean to offend anybody. But in terms of physical beauty, Warsaw is not what Prague is or what Krakow is. And so I figured, well, I could go to Prague and I would actually speak sort of halfway to the language, because Polish and Czech, as you know, are very closely related. And so if I spoke Polish, I would be able to sort of get by in Czech until I learned the language. And that's what I did.
You went without any specific position, but very quickly you were freelancing for the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah. The Tribune said – I got commitments from about, I don't know, a half dozen newspapers that they would at least accept my collect phone calls, which at the time was a very big deal. And I got – the San Francisco Chronicle actually gave me a letter of accreditation. So my business card said San Francisco Chronicle. In the end, I worked mostly for the Tribune, but I worked for – a whole slew, about a dozen newspapers. I worked for the Boston Globe, the Baltimore Sun, the Miami Herald, the Toronto Globe and Mail, all of that kind of – that second tier of U.S. newspapers from kind of in circulation numbers 5 to 25.
Now, as I recall, I'm trying to think back when I was in Warsaw in 1989 and meeting some of the foreign journalists there. There was one correspondent and his wife was serving as East European correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. I don't know whether she was there at the same time.
Well, I wasn't on staff for the Tribune. I was a freelancer, and they always did have somebody in Warsaw. The Tribune did, and those people would sometimes come to Prague, and I would help them out, or you know. But mostly, they would just take my stories and run them, you know. And they were very interested in what was happening there. So I had. I think the year that I did the most for the Tribune, I did 50 or 60 stories, you know, which is more or less what a staff correspondent would write, even though I was a freelancer. But it was great because I could also work for other people and take a lot of time off. Both my children were born in Prague, and when my first daughter was born, I took about 4 months off that year because I was a freelancer. It was perfect.
You mentioned knowing Polish already and then learning Czech, and you had previously learned French and Italian. How much of an advantage did that knowledge of languages give you, particularly, let's say, in working in Prague? French and Italian aren't going to help you there, but just the ability to handle a foreign language when some foreign correspondents can't.
Well, I think that speaking a language is fundamentally important to your job in a foreign country, although I have since done fairly extensive reporting in China and Japan where I don't speak a word of the language. And you can do it, but you miss a lot of the nuance and the cultural context and everything. And to be perfectly honest, on one level, you could say that I sort of spoke negative Czech when I got there, because there are certain things that one says in Polish – and they mean something entirely different in Czech, and things that are so vulgar that I couldn't say them on public radio.
In 1997, you joined the Wall Street Journal, or reporting from Prague.
Yeah.
What led you to make the change?
Opportunity. It was very early. The Eastern European Czech story became an economic story. It was a cultural story. It was a political story, but the whole process of dismantling this thing called communism and turning it into a capitalist economy was fundamentally a story of economics. And so I started doing more and more economic stories, and a friend of mine, Neil King, had been in Prague freelancing for the journal, and he moved to Brussels to work for them full time, and he said, "Do you want to do this?" And I said, "Sure." And so I took it up. With the journal, I was also more or less freelance. I had a slightly more permanent status with the journal than I did with the Tribune, but I was still fundamentally a freelancer for them. And so I could still work for the Tribune and other papers as well, although I did most of my work for the journal. But it was just – it was opportunity, and it seemed – you know, the journal is a fantastic newspaper, and it was a great chance to work for them. So I took it.
It strikes me that you didn't have a whole lot of background in economics. So was it difficult to develop the expertise for reporting on those kinds of subjects?
Oh, it still is. No, I don't have any formal training in economics. I know what I've learned on the job, and it's a very arcane field that I wouldn't profess to have a deep, deep understanding of. But fortunately, the people who now work for me have a greater understanding of it than I do. And my reporting at the time from Eastern Europe was probably somewhat – I'm sure it would have been better if I'd had greater training in economics. But I did learn a lot, and a lot of the fundamentals of how a market economy works and things, which was something that people there truly didn't have an understanding of. You know, we're just born with it. We get it because it's what we live every day, and that wasn't what they lived every day there. And so it was fairly easy for me to see those inconsistencies, you know, people's desires versus their understanding of the market and what that meant, and that made for a lot of fascinating stories.
Did you have a tendency to write more of the political aspects of it, or were you focusing on the economic nuts
and
bolts?
More the economic nuts and bolts, which is really a more interesting story. One thing that American readers anywhere really don't care about is the inner workings of politics in other countries. People just don't, you know, they don't really want to even know. They didn't want to know that Klaus was the finance minister, and they certainly didn't want to know how he and Havel were kind of at each other's throats. And then when you get down to, you know, those are the two headline names. And when you get down to the names that are even less known abroad, even though they're superstars in the Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia at the time, there's very little interest among readers in the personal conflicts of politicians in other countries. So I tended to avoid those.
Why did you leave Prague?
Oh, it was time to go. Business Week offered me a job in the Atlanta Bureau, a place that I'd never been, and it felt as foreign to me as Bratislava might to most people around here. It was a great opportunity. I thought I'd check it out. I'd been in Prague for 8 years. I had two children. They weren't Czech. My wife is not Czech. I didn't have any deep cultural connection to being Czech that went beyond my tenure in the country. And so I didn't necessarily want my kids to grow up Czech, which it sounds less respectful than it is. It's not a question of respect for Czechs or anything. It's just – it was a culture that was somewhat alien to me, and I wanted my kids to grow up in my culture. And so I took it.
What drew you to Business Week?
Just a great publication, a great name, and a good opportunity to cover. I was brought into Atlanta to cover telecommunications, which again was at a turning point. This was just when WorldCom was rising, you know, which turned out to be a real kind of a can of worms. But I saw it as an opportunity to get into a top-notch U.S. publication, and I'm glad that I came.
Did you have any regrets about leaving? You mentioned wanting to bring your family back to an American environment. Did you have any regrets about leaving the field of international reporting at the time?
Oh, yeah. Well, and I felt regrets about leaving the field of international living at the time too. Living abroad is for me it's a voyage of discovery every day. Every minute you're out and you see things that are strange and alien, and you learn. You're a sponge, and it's fantastic, and I love it. And despite the fact that I'd never been to Atlanta, I was ultimately relatively familiar with the culture. So there wasn't a day that went by that I didn't say, why am I here? And yet it was the right decision. I turned down a job in London to take the Business Week job with a telecommunications consultancy called the Yankee Group. And they told me that I'd be living in London and you have to do some travel. You'll probably go to Barcelona, Paris, Amsterdam, Geneva. And then I interviewed with Business Week and they said, you'll have to do some travel. You'll probably go to Birmingham, Jackson, Mobile. But I'm still glad I did it. You know, okay, Birmingham isn't Barcelona maybe, but it's got its good points too.
what do you think was the biggest lesson you learned in Atlanta?
I learned lessons big and small. You know, you come back to America after 8 years abroad and things have changed. You know, like I remember my wife was in the supermarket line and she said she was asked, paper or plastic? And she said, I'm paying cash. We didn't have a choice between paper and plastic bags before I left. So then I learned a lot about sort of having a real job. You know, I hadn't really had a real job in 8 years or 9 years at the time. I'd been a freelancer. I'd been on my own. And so the process of going to work, which was not in my home, because in Prague I always worked at my house, and to actually get in a car, be driven, you know, to ride a bike downtown and go to an office and go to work and be separated from my family was a shock for me.
You've done several other things before going back into the international world. One of them was a monthly technological supplement to Business Week called E.Biz. What was that?
Yeah. We called it just E.Biz. And it was it was during the internet boom, and we were it was a phenomenally successful publication while it lasted, which was maybe 2 years, 2.5 years, something like that. I was not a founding editor of it. My boss, Kathy Rubello, was. They sensed an interest among a lot of the dot-com companies to have a publication that was focused on what they did, which was, you know, this thing called the internet. And so they built this publication that wrote about Silicon Valley and the internet and the new net companies and everything. And it was incredibly successful. There was one or two issues where it was stapled inside Business Week and it got so big that we couldn't – the size of the staples was the limiting factor on how big we could get. And so the E-Biz that was stapled inside Business Week was actually 8 pages bigger than the Business Week that surrounded it at its absolute height. And that was in mid-2000 sometime. And so in 2001, we kind of knew that there would be a downturn. So we planned instead of a 128 or 136-page book, we figured, okay, we'll scale it back to 48 for the January 2001 issue. Then we scaled it back to 36. Then we scaled back to 24. Then 16, and then we killed it. We sold one ad for that. I mean, it was just an absolute off a cliff kind of decrease in the advertising that came in. So E-Biz didn't exist anymore after 2001. So they needed somebody to do the Asia beat, and although I'd never set foot in Asia, they asked me if I wanted to be the Asia editor, and so I said sure, and that led me back to international. They knew that I'd wanted to get back into international.
Well, you were also what, computer editor at one time?
That was just I covered IBM, and I kind of oversaw the hardware part of our tech coverage. So I worked with our reporters in Silicon Valley and in Asia occasionally and in Europe, just kind of coordinating the coverage of hardware and mostly writing stories. Although at Business Week we call everybody an editor, many people are called editors or really reporters, and that was mostly what I did.
Let's come back to that, the Asia business. Bob Gillette, who one time was the Los Angeles Times correspondent in Moscow and Warsaw, and was looking for another assignment. And I asked him, well, why not China? And he said, well, he couldn't fit in very well in China the way he could in Eastern Europe. Did you find the experience of being in Asia quite different from your previous time abroad?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. I never lived in Asia, but I have traveled there quite extensively. I've spent over the past 6 years, I've probably spent a total of 3 or 4 months in Asia on various trips. It's a totally different experience. You know, they in Eastern Europe, people, you know, my father was born in Vienna, and so I look the part. People would come up to me on the street and ask me for directions all the time. You know, that doesn't happen in Japan very often. You know, I do not look Japanese, I guarantee it, even though those of you who can only hear my voice, you have to imagine that I don't. It is very different. You're always immediately identified as being an outsider. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, you can get access into places as an outsider that you can't if you're perceived as an insider. There are plenty of examples of the inverse, but you can, if you play it right, you can still do quite well there and fit in a way that you need to.
Do you see Asia as being a geographical concept or a cultural concept? Because you have China and India and Japan and Korea and other countries with quite different things going on.
Yeah, it's to consider Asia as a region like Europe. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, you know, just immense differences in culture and cultural tradition and everything. At the same time, and in fact, I would say that if you look at China or India alone, each one of them is kind of like its own little Europe. You know, there's many languages and cultures and things as there are in Europe. And you know, a northern Chinese is just as different from a southern Chinese as a Norwegian is from an Italian, probably, maybe even more so. Obviously, right now there are similarities between India and China. You know, they're both a billion plus people, and they're rising powerhouses. The similarities, on some level, end there, but they do make a very good foil for contrasting one against the other. And I think it's important for Americans to understand both and really get a sense of what is happening there and why we should care. And that's why I love what I do.
Do you have a philosophy of covering Asia? Some kind of themes or anything of that sort?
We have a lot of themes. I don't know if a philosophy of covering Asia. I wouldn't say that I do in any way. But the themes are the rise of China, the rise of India, how that affects the rest of the world and what it means, whether these companies, you know, from a business standpoint, of course, which is what I look at, what do the changes in those two countries mean for Americans? What do they mean for Europeans? How will people who are willing to work for a lot less money in those two countries affect the job situation here? In Japan, I think, you know, one needs to look at the – it's an incredibly precision-oriented technological society, and how are they adapting to the to their own economic woes and what they did? Because I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned from the Japanese experience of the past decade for our current situation. So in that way, you know, those would be the kinds of major themes that we try and look at. But you know, I wouldn't call it a philosophy, I guess.
Do you see particular challenges now in covering the impact of the world economic decline in countries like India and China that have been growing so fast?
Well, the challenges aren't in covering it. The challenges are for them, really. And as a journalist, you know, it's fantastic. You know, I mean, you know, it sounds crass, and I don't mean it in that way, but. As a journalist, you know, what do you want? You know, you want all kinds of mayhem, right? And so as a business journalist, you know, what could be better than the second Great Depression? Now, of course, I don't really mean that, but it's a very interesting time and how all of these countries are adapting and changing, reacting to what's happening here is fascinating. I mean, I think that a few as recently as 6 months ago, a lot of people thought that they had largely decoupled from the global economy, that China would not only continue to expand at these really incredibly high rates, but also would maybe even pull us out of our own economic doldrums. And that's been shown to be just completely wrong. You know, it's so totally tied to the U.S. You know, when we don't buy that fourth DVD player or, you know, that 25th pair of shoes or whatever, somebody in China loses her job. And, you know, and it's a very direct relationship.
Let's take a break here and listen to some music. You mentioned earlier you had played in some bands, and I understand we may hear some of your own music.
You could say that I'm the Pete Best of Poland, actually. If for those of you who don't remember who Pete Best is, he was the original drummer for the Beatles. Not that I'm a drummer. I'm a guitar player and a singer. But I was in a band that was called Przydelsi, which means poodles in Polish. And I was their original lead singer. The Przydelsi, after I left, and perhaps because I left, they went on to great stardom. They became something like the Rolling Stones of Poland in the 90s. And I was left behind being a journalist. Why don't we go with a Przydelsi song that I'm not singing?
Pantera na łańcuchu, wąż u szyi zwisa, małpa, szarabara, naga córka Elvisa. Kim jestem przystojny mulat, 10 lat pustował włosy, kiedy bielą skórę. Co to za Bóg, to wielki słuch. Skaczą białe małpy, łupami przekręcają, nogami wypijając, za jaja się trzymają.
That was music chosen by our guest on Profiles today, David Rocks, who is the senior editor for international news for Business Week. Support comes from Smithville Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones. Smithville Telephone, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. You took up that position of senior editor in 2005. Covering the world these days is a daunting task. How do you organize the world?
by geographically, as we talked about before, we have our Asia staff and our Europe staff, and we have one person in Latin America. And we don't have anybody in Africa, but we cover it more or less from Europe, and Australia would be the same. That's covered out of Asia. So we try and get stories that wrap up, you know, either regionally or globally, and we do that several times a year. But we also we look at what's happening in each country. But it's very hard. You know, it's a real 24-hour job because you know, I leave the office and go home, and Asia's waking up, and so I'm on the phone with them at night, and then I wake up, and early morning I'm on the phone with Europe because it's their afternoon, and I might be talking to somebody in Asia as well because it's their night, and then I work through my day, and then I start it all over again. But it's also the time difference can help too, because when the Asians will file their stories in their evening, you know, so 7 or 8 in the morning my time, it's 12-hour difference to China, and 13 to Tokyo if you're in the summer, and in the winter it's 13 or 14. So I get their stories in, and I can work on them during the day while they're sleeping, and then I send them back to them and ask them for corrections overnight. So it works out pretty well.
What defines the magazine's agenda, news agenda?
We see ourselves as a publication that serves business readers with the information that they need to do their job well. We aim at a very high level of reader, and we actually get that very high level of reader. People in senior management positions, and you know, and of course people who aspire to senior management positions. And we seek to give them information, news, stories that will help them understand the world around them in our domestic coverage, you know, just understand the economy and the business cycle and everything. In global coverage, understand what's happening in other countries and give them actionable insights so that they can take something away from the story and say, okay, in my business, even though this is a story about a car company, if I sell computers, I understand something about China that will help me do better at that.
How much of the agenda is planned news and how much of it reacts to events?
On some level, you know, everything is reactive. It's just a matter of how quickly you react. In the magazine, I would say that it's probably a third is reacting to something that's very current in that week or, you know, a couple weeks period. And about two-thirds is stories that have been in a longer planning cycle. Every month we have what we call a cover meeting or a cover and feature meeting where we plan our cover schedule out about three and a half months. And that's a schedule that never, ever, ever comes true. But it gives us kind of a roadmap and then, you know, and then we cycle through and the next month we reorganize and we figure, okay, well, this story is not happening. This story really needs to come in now, whatever. So it's roughly a third. Online, it's probably more it's maybe a half that's kind of newsy, today's news, maybe even three quarters online.
I'm glad that you mentioned the online version because that really raises this issue that has been facing news magazines in particular, Newsweek. It is said might be considering going to a biweekly schedule. U.S. News and World Report is having difficulty hanging on. What do you see as the future of a magazine like Business Week? Is it going to be online or are these all dinosaurs?
Well, we'll definitely be online. The question is whether we'll print. And I personally think that we will print for, you know, at least another 5 or 10 years. I do think that there will come a time when we won't print. I don't think it's imminent at all. I think that there is still a lot of value in having a physical pile of paper that you can hold and thumb through and read. I think of online as sitting as I am now forward against the mic and a magazine is – you'll hear the difference. I'm back leaning back and those are to me two very different – reading experiences. One is a much more relaxed and I find a mode in which I'm much more receptive to actually getting the information in and really internalizing it and understanding it deeply. I think that online is great for knowing what's happening on a day-to-day basis and understanding, getting a sense of the news. But if you want real insight, for me at least, as a kind of old guy, I think that my insight is much better received in more of a, you know, a prone position, as it were. And so I think that there are a lot of people who feel that way. Now, I don't know that my kids do. And I also think that someday in the not too distant future, somebody will come up with a reader like a super iPhone that will be somewhere vaguely about the size of a magazine that will have a color screen and you will be able to very comfortably read in a sit back as opposed to sit forward position.
Isn't there this new – what is it called? Kindle from
– Yeah, it's – the Kindle is fine. I've never actually used one but I've seen them. It's fine but it's not there yet. It's nowhere near there yet. What you really want is a display that is something vaguely akin to a magazine or a newspaper that's more durable. It can maybe be folded or rolled up. It's light. It's got longer battery life. And these are all questions of technology that it will happen. It's just a matter of will it happen in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? I don't know. I'm sure it'll be less than 20. It'll probably be less than 10. But it's – and when that happens – I still think that there will be some magazines that will print on paper. I think, you know, Skiing Magazine or Vogue or these kind of things probably will continue to print. I'm not sure that Business Week will. Not that I'm party to these decisions at Business Week anyway, but be my guess.
Do you think that these kinds of changes will be hastened by the world economic downturn, the decline of the advertising market?
Well, what will be hastened is the death of some magazines. I don't think that Business Week is going anywhere anytime soon, and I won't name any of my esteemed colleagues by name. But I do think that you will see a shakeout in some magazines. I mean, you can't – the advertising has dried up. I mean, there just is – there's very little advertising, and so and we depend on advertisers for any profit and for a lot of our operating expenses. And for most magazines in the U.S., the price of a subscription covers the cost of printing and mailing. And so you know, my salary and the cost of the content and any profit comes from advertising.
Now, if the amount of money coming in is declining, how does that impact your specific area, that is the gathering of foreign news? Are you having fewer correspondents, commissioning fewer stories from freelancers? What's the impact?
Well, we don't actually use freelancers very much, so that's not that much of an issue. We do a little bit, and we've kind of reined in the freelance budget a little bit. Today, Business Week actually has a bigger foreign staff than any U.S. magazine. Now, that there are newspapers that have more than we do, but we have, which effectively means we have more than Time and Newsweek because they're the only other ones who had a significant overseas presence. But our presence. We have, depending on how you count the positions that we have overseas, we've got about between 15 and 20 people overseas now. That's down from probably 30 to 35 5 or 10 years ago. So there has been a significant decline in the number of people that we have overseas. I don't think that there's been that much decline in the amount of news that we're producing. That we're producing from overseas, they're all working harder. And there's a huge appetite for global news among our readers. We do readership surveys fairly often. And every time they come back and say, we want global news, we want more global news.
It's interesting you mentioned Time and Newsweek as kind of magazine competitors. Some people would say, where's The Economist, a magazine whose circulation has come up and does devote a fair amount of coverage to business and the economy?
The Economist is absolutely a competitor. At Time and Newsweek aren't really competitors of ours in that directly. We pay attention to what they do and they do a fine job. Our direct competitors are Fortune and Forbes and The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times and The Financial Times and, of course, The Economist. And The Economist is a terrific magazine. I read it every week, and they've been very good at covering the world. But they do something that's very different from what we do. I don't know whether they would say this because I don't know very many people who work at The Economist. I've only met a couple over the years. But as far as I can – just reading the magazine, they're kind of a newspaper of record for the world, right? They call
themselves a newspaper, in fact.
Yeah, right. And they will tell you what – they will give you 5 pages of news from Africa regardless of what happened in Africa that week, you know. And that's fine. But a lot of what they do is telling you what happened. It's a digest of the news. And it's a good digest. It's well written. It's complete. It's, you know, I'm not denigrating them in any way. But it's quite different from what we do. We don't see ourselves as a digest of the news. We see ourselves as a place to go for insights to understand the news of today or tomorrow.
I find it fascinating that you said in the surveys of readers that you do that you find continued or even growing interest in world news, because that seems to go against the common wisdom among news media in the United States.
And it may have to do – I'm sure it has something to do with our readers. You know, our readers are – business people, and if you're in business, especially if you're at a big company and you're at any level of responsibility, if you don't know what's going on in the world, then you won't have your job for very long. I think also you have to look at the forces that are affecting, say, the Chicago Tribune, which would be a very good example of a paper that has really scaled back its foreign coverage. And the conventional wisdom is go local with newspapers, and that probably makes sense for these papers. I don't want to criticize what they do. But what they're offering when they do international is what the New York Times does, but the New York Times is some people might say it's better, some people might not, but it's certainly more comprehensive. And the New York Times is available in physical form anywhere in the US pretty much now, and in digital form anywhere in the world. And so that really creates a disincentive to a paper like the Tribune to spend resources. I mean, it's expensive to do foreign news. I mean, this is not a cheap thing that we do at all. I mean, our budget is huge. You know, you're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars a year per correspondent when you add up salary and bureau expenses and travel expenses.
Is there something in the more general, and I'm leading you into an area where you're not as comfortable talking, but is there something in general about an American audience that's not involved in business that is very, how should we say this, provincial, not interested in the larger world?
Yeah, and with good reason. You know, if you're in Europe, you get in your car and you drive, and in a couple hours you're in another country. They're speaking a different language. They're eating different food. They do different folk dancing. You know, they all dress the same now. They're all wearing Gap or whatever, and it's all made in China. But Americans, we're in America. We don't for decades we didn't really need the rest of the world, or at least you could. I don't agree with that statement, but you could see how a person could think that. And so, yeah, I think that there is a lack of interest about what goes on outside of the U.S. among a lot of Americans. And would I criticize that? I mean, sort of, but I can understand why. I don't think it's healthy, but I can certainly understand why it's the case.
And then one thinks back to how you started out. You know, why would somebody from Colorado want to go overseas? What was the stimulus that got you interested?
I grew up in Colorado Springs, and I ended up going to college in Maine, which, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but I realize now it was the farthest place from Colorado Springs that was still in this country. And then I went overseas. It was all kind of a pattern of just wanting to. I'm an explorer. I always want to go, and I would drive my wife crazy if we go one way going to someplace. I always want to take a different route back because I want to see what the other part of it looks like. And so I always want to get out and see things. And as I was saying earlier, living overseas is this incredible voyage of discovery every second of the day. And so that's what I wanted to go and do and see.
You kind of wandered into covering business news because of your experience. Where do you find the good reporters for Business Week?
I think a good reporter is somebody who can I really do want them to speak the language, and in most places our reporters do speak the language very fluently. There are a couple of small exceptions now. I want somebody who has a good fundamental understanding of business and of economics. I want somebody who has the perseverance to go out and find the story and won't take no. And I want somebody who understands that what we do is not so much providing information as telling stories. You need to be able to go out and see the whole of the situation and be able to describe it in a very colorful and engaging way and salt the information into it so that people are, you know, they're getting their spinach with their dessert sort of built in there. And I think that there are a lot of good people out there who can do that, and then there are a lot of people who don't do that very well, frankly.
Is the job of a business reporter easier or harder when there's a severe economic downturn?
Oh, much easier. That's fantastic times to be a business reporter. There's so many stories that are out there that are just fantastic, and there are so many wonderful tales of perfidy and everything, you know, which we love to tell. It's a very easy time. The hardest thing is deciding what not to write, in a sense.
But some people would argue that in a time of economic difficulty, the traditional notions about the success of capitalism. I guess Forbes magazine would be an example of this. Those kinds of themes about how everything is good make it easier to tell stories. And when things are bad, it's more difficult.
Well, it depends. You know, I don't see us as cheerleaders for the capitalist party. I think that we are we like to think of ourselves as impartial observers of a market-based economy. And we tell the we like to tell it warts and all. Do we do that all the time? No. And there are times when we do become more cheerleaderish than I would necessarily like. But I think that that overall we've been pretty good. I think not just us, but the whole business press was pretty good with this round with the subprime crisis. I mean, I think we were writing about subprime 2 and 3 years ago. And the first time I ever heard the term subprime was when I was in Atlanta in 2000. You know, my colleague there, Dean Faust, was writing stories about subprime. Saying, you know, and I'd never heard the term. I thought subprime, that must mean mortgages that are less expensive than other people. You know, they're more expensive. Why is that? I don't know, because the borrowers are less than prime. But So you know, we've been writing about it and we were warning it. I think what surprised us, surprised everybody, was the speed with which it happened and the just the, you know, the depth, the, you know, how interconnected everything was. We didn't understand that, and the people who were making the connections didn't understand it either. But we were warning, and there were a lot of people who were warning about, you know, these people are people who shouldn't be getting mortgages are getting them.
And people didn't hear. Why?
You tell me.
That brings us to the conclusion of this conversation. Our guest today has been David Rocks of Business Week. David, at the conclusion, we'd like to hear some more music that you would recommend.
Okay. How about a song that I wrote that's based on my experiences in Poland called Underground Emotion? Here you go.
And the performer?
That's me.
Okay.
And my band, Her Dog Henry.
David, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
David Rocks, Senior International Editor for Business Week. For WFIU, I'm Owen Johnson.
Don't look in my coat, Mr. Customs Man. The happiness in there has been a long time banned. Sewn into the liners, a pocket full of anger. If he finds that, I'll get 5 years or even longer. Well, I'm smuggling in some underground emotion. I said I'm smuggling in some underground emotion. I'll flood the market with something that can't be a ration. Ooh, everybody's gonna be high on illegal passion.
The program you have just heard was recorded in January of 2009. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Support comes from Smithville Telephone Company, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, offering bundled packages, high-speed internet, and wireless phones. Smithville Telephone, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.